You know, it's kind of interesting to notice the discussions that go on the web and the newspaper and what have you. There are a lot of people that are not in church today. The reason that they're not in church is around perceived personal needs. If you look at the back of the bulletin, I have a couple of these in the second paragraph. These are comments people make. These are comments our kids sometimes make. They may not make it to us, but they make it to themselves. Maybe some of the things that are in your mind. Because a lot of folks are saying this morning, I don't need to go to church to be a good person. I hear that a lot. My response is, well, yeah, probably so. Of course, you could be a lot better person if you had a little more reinforcement. But I understand that. And some of you are saying, church is boring. Why? You say, well, we got song leaders that don't sing perfectly. Yeah, none of us sing perfectly. Do you think that God cares? You say, well, you got a boring sermon, a boring class. Why does that happen? You say, well, we got a lousy preacher. I understand that, but that doesn't excuse boredom. You know, worship and what we do here is about life. And life is not boring. There's too many things that happen to us, with us, in us, and about us that make it pretty difficult to be bored. You can have other problems. And then there are those who say, oh, I don't need that crutch. I can function on my own. You don't need that crutch. Well, then what crutch do you use? Because none of us stand alone. You know, some people's crutch is alcohol. Some people's crutch is drugs. Some people's crutch is education. Some people's crutch is their husband or wife. Some people's crutch is their boat. That's probably not happening today, but it's a crutch. It's a means by which we face the difficulties of life. And some people are saying, and we might say, well, I just don't believe that stuff. You know, I respect those that aren't here this morning because they have said openly and clearly, I don't believe. But my question is, have you done anything to investigate the evidence? If you go out through the fellowship room, you'll see a sign up against the wall. Last weekend, I was in Wallingford, Connecticut. The sign says, let's talk about whether God exists. Take a look at it. It's kind of an interesting sign. They put 2,000 of those out. We had a auditorium of 450 people. It was full. By the way, that congregation on a good Sunday morning has 70 people. It's not a big church, but it's an active church. They're not bored. Let me tell you something. Willie Franklin's going to be here at the end of May. I guarantee you, you will not be bored listening to Willie. No way. But we don't need a fantastic speaker like he is to not be bored. The problem is us. And then somebody says, well, I have better things to do on my time on my day off. Really? What you going to do today? You know, I think it's interesting to realize that we all have these temptations. But I think it's also important to ask yourself, our culture is doing this. They're using these things. We hear this from everybody. Our kids are parroting this a lot. Are we a happy bunch? Is our culture a happy culture? Look at the data. We have the highest suicide rate in the United States at every age level of any culture in the history of the planet. Does that sound like we're a happy culture? Alcoholism is rampant. We have a discussion about opiates. It's a crisis. Does that make us happy? Drug use, family strife? What's the fastest growing field of college graduates today? Answer, marriage counselors, psychologists. Why? We're not happy. What's the number one problem the military says they're having with recruits? Depression. Does that sound like a happy culture? And what's interesting is that when you're around a group of Christians, you have a whole different picture. And if you don't believe that, come to my house Tuesday, 7 o'clock. It's a happy bunch. My problem with Tuesday night is I always end up with my sides sore from laughing. And it's not just Bill Gibson. He's good for that, but we got a whole house full of those people. Christians are happy. They have a high level of happiness. And the church functions and answers these areas. There are two major points I'd like to make this morning. Reason number one, why you need to be in church and why we need to encourage our friends and our neighbors and our family to be here. And I want to emphasize, it's not because we have great song leaders. It's not because we have a good preacher. It's not because we have fantastic teachers. That's not where it's at. But we have a need for a higher power. Every human being has a need for a higher power. You know, if you go to an Alcoholics Anonymous or a Narc Anonymous or any of those anonymouses, you know what the very first statement is on all of them? Learn to look to a higher power. Why? Because you have a need for a higher power. And if you don't have a recognition of the focus of your existence, then one of two things are going to happen. Your focus of your existence has to become me, I. It's kind of interesting. Have you ever thought about what's happened to magazine titles in the last 25 years? 25 years ago, what were the major magazines? Well, the number one one was Life. That's pretty broad. Okay? It's pretty broad. Life magazine. And we had a whole group of magazines that were along that line, talking about everyday activities of people. And then as we moved down, a few years later, People magazine started. Well, People's not just life. People narrows it down a little bit to just you and me. And after People got going pretty good, then we had Us. Well, that's narrower than People. That's you and me. What are the magazines now? Me, self. What's happened to our focus? We're looking inward. And we either become depressed if the focus is us, or we become arrogant if the focus is us. It's easy for an eye focus to get distorted and to start looking at things that lead you to all those things we just talked about. Family strife, alcoholism, opiates, etc., etc., etc. You know, the book of Job talks about this. You might turn to Job, the first chapter. I think sometimes we don't catch all of what is going on in the book of Job because the book of Job teaches us about our needs. Job 1:1 tells us about a guy that was perfect in outward things. Listen to Job 1:1. In the land of Uz, there lived a man whose name was Job. This man was blameless and upright. He feared God and shunned evil. Okay, we got a guy here that is the perfect outward image. Blameless and upright. But I bet you've never heard this point. I bet you've never heard anybody suggest that Job's heart had some problems. His focus, and the focus of the first part of the book of Job, is on me, I. Listen to verses 3 and 4 and think about what is being said as to what his focus is. He had seven sons and three daughters. and he owned 7,000 sheep. Wow, you ever see 7,000 sheep? 3,000 camels. That's a lot of camels. 100 yoke of oxen and 500 donkeys. You getting a mental picture here? And had a large number of servants. He was the greatest man among all the people of the East. Well, that's me, isn't it? The criteria is how successful I have been. Not only that, but he jumps through all of the required hoops of the day. Listen to verse 4. His sons used to take turns holding feast in their homes. And they would invite their three sisters to eat and drink with them. Boy, that's a... I don't know about your family. My family, when you get brothers and sisters together, there's usually an argument. But that's not the way this was. When the period of feasting had run its course, Job would send and have them purified. What's he doing? Well, keep reading. Early in the morning, he would sacrifice a burnt offering for each of them, thinking, perhaps my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. And this was Job's regular custom. Hey, this guy jumped through all the religious hoops. He did all the right things. He was highly successful. Owned a lot. I can't imagine that many animals. And he did do all the religious rituals that were possible at the time. What's the problem? He had a heart problem. His focus was on me. I. And you see that as you read through in Job 6 and verse 8. Job says, oh, that I might have my request, that God would grant me what I hope for. What does he hope for? What does he want? He wants all his stuff to be restored. He wants his camels back. He wants his sheep back. He wants his kids back. He wants everything back the way it was. The things that gave him prestige. The focus is me. The focus is I. And so Satan comes along and Satan has a challenge. Ladies and gentlemen, the challenge is the same challenge that Satan has to you. Because Satan says, Job has not been tested. Of course he stays with you, God. Because look at all he has. He's got all those camels. He's got all those sheep. He doesn't have any problems. He's never been tested. He hasn't dealt with real life. It's easy to look good when you don't have any problems. Isn't that true? Isn't that true? In the eyes of the world, it's easy to look good if you don't have any problems. But when catastrophe comes, his focus changes. And his friend's focus changes to God from me. And we do the same thing. Do you ever say verbally or inside, why me? Why me? God, this isn't fair. Why me? I didn't deserve this. Why me? Haven't you ever said that? Hasn't that ever been in your thinking? Boy, it's been in my thinking. And Job can't make sense out of what's happened to him at this point. He calls God into question. Job says, oh, that I might have my request and that God would grant me the thing I long for. Even that it would please God to destroy me, that he would loose his hand and cut me off. See, Job has his own belief system. He has been on the throne. And he's been kicked off the throne. And he doesn't like it. Yeah, I've had things happen in my life that kicked me off the throne. Things didn't go the way I wanted them to. But what happens is that God brings Job back. God brings Job back to the realization that he needs a higher power. In the 38th chapter, look how God does, beginning with verse 1, really pretty sarcastic. Then the Lord, answered Job out of a storm, and he said, "Who is this that darkens my counsel with words without knowledge? Brace yourself like a man, and I will question you, and you shall answer me. Where were you when I laid the earth's foundation? Tell me if you understand." He goes on and on and on and on with what Job doesn't know, because Job has been totally reliant upon Job. Job hasn't seen any further than his own hand. And this discussion, and you can read the 38, 39 chapters, this discussion changes Job's focus. Look at what Job says in Job 40, beginning with verse 4. "I am unworthy," Job says. "How can I reply to you, God? I put my hand over my mouth." Have you ever asked God for something that was so preposterous, later on you said, "I can't believe I did that. I can't believe I said that." "I spoke once, but I have no answer. Twice, but I will say no more." And so what happens is that Job's attention is shifted away from his selfish, "Look at me, deny my need for God," and look at what he says in Job 42, beginning with verse 1. This is the end of the book of Job. "And Job replied to the Lord, 'I know that you can do all things. No plan of yours can be thwarted.'" Oh boy. See, what's happened is he's turned his attention now from realizing, you know, "I can plan all this stuff. I can plan for the camels, the sheep. I can plan for my kids. I can plan that everything will go good in my life. I can plan to make money. But ultimately, I have no control over any of that." But that's not the way it is with you. "No plan of yours can be thwarted." Verse 3, "You asked, 'Who is this who obscures my counsel without knowledge?'" Yeah, we think we're smart. Not when catastrophes come into our lives. "I don't have the answers when tragedy hits, do you? Surely I spoke of things I did not understand." Yeah. "Things too wonderful for me to know." See, what's happening is he's turned his attention from me and I and self and us. He's turned it to God and said, "I know, God, I need you. I need that higher power. I need that strength to deal with things, especially when life goes bad. You said, 'Listen now and I will speak. I will question you and you shall answer me.'" And then verse 5, oh, listen to this one. "My ears had heard of you by the ears, but now my eyes have seen you. And I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes." Have you ever gotten to the point in your life where that applies to you? Where you said to yourself, maybe not verbally, maybe you haven't even categorized it, but you've said, "You know, I've heard about God. Yeah, I've been to church. I heard the preacher. I heard the Bible class teacher. I know what my parents taught me. Yeah, I've heard about God. But boy, I sure didn't understand. Until reality came around, I did not understand. And now, faced with tragedy, faced with loss, faced with the reality that my life is not in my control, now I see you, God. I see why you're important to me. I understand that I need the higher power. I no longer will be the arrogant, selfish person that only looks at me. I know there has to be something better, something higher. God, I need you." Have you ever been to the point where you said, "God, I need you"? You ever said that? You ever thought about the dependence upon God? We need that. But the second point that I want to make is, we need to understand and understand the continuance of what I just said. Let me read you one more passage that might get you to think about this. Isaiah 55, beginning with verse 8. Listen to what Isaiah said about this. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, God says. Neither are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. As the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. As the rain and the snow come down from heaven and do not return to it without watering the earth and making it bud and flourish, so that it yields seed for the sower and bread for the eater, so is my word that goes out of my mouth. This is God talking. It will not return to me empty, but will accomplish what I desire and achieve the purpose for which I sent it. Can you focus on something higher than you? What is your arrogance level? We need to answer that to ourselves and to God. What really brings satisfaction in life? Unity, joy, peace. They openly come when our focus is not on us. But that brings me to point number two. Humans need to feel safe. In all circumstances, we need to feel loved. We need to be cared for. I saw Willard come in today. It brought tears to my eyes. Willard's wife passed away, what's it been, 3 or 4 weeks? He's alone now. The relatives have all gone home. I have sat at the kitchen table and wept because I was so lonely. See, Willard needs us. Willard needs us. And Willard's not the kind of guy that's going to stand up and say that. He's a strong man. He's a man that's been dedicated to God. Willard and I have walked that trash clean up a lot of times. We have a sister, Adele Durham. Adele took a fall. She's been at all of our senior stuff. She took a fall, and now she can't feel her legs. She can't walk. She's in a nursing home. Those of you that get the senior bulletin, the phone number's in there. See, what's happening is that when you get to our age and life comes around and we start having all these problems. I mean, Richard and Tina are dealing with difficult situations in their family. So one nice thing about our small group is we know what everybody's going through and we have the capacity to act and to do something about it. We need to be loved. We need to be cared for. We need to be people who want to help. I told Willard this morning, I wish I could punch a button and make it all go away. But it hurts. And if you haven't lost your husband, you haven't lost your wife, you haven't lost your child, you can't possibly understand how much it hurts. But brothers and sisters, we need to let our people who are hurting know we care. Ephesians 4, beginning in verse 1, we're told, walk worthy of the vocation wherewith you were called, with all lowliness and meekness, with long suffering, forbearing one another in love. That's what we're supposed to be about. Endeavoring to keep the unity of the Spirit and the bond of peace. See, what that passage tells us is that our vocation as Christians, remember what it said? Walk worthy of the vocation with which you are called. Our vocation is peace and love and caring. Our vocation is not debates over issues. Our vocation is not conflict. Our vocation is not prestige, money. Our vocation is caring. Take some time this week. Call, write, pray. I mean, that sheet that Carl and Julie are preparing for us gives us a whole plethora of people that need us to behave as Christians. We need to let everyone we know that is a brother and sister Christ know that they are cared for Bill and Maylene aren't here this morning. We know all the stuff they're going through. They need to know they're cared for. They're loved. You got their phone number. If you don't have a directory, ask us. We'll give you one. Send a card. Send a letter. Call. Visit if you can. Ministry kills arrogance. And our diversity lets everyone get involved. If we understand our mission, then we won't let that happen. You know, in 1 Corinthians 5, there's a story about a man who threw everything to the wind. Morally, he jumped into the world's standards. He's sleeping with his mother-in-law. And yet he's a member of the church. And Paul writes to them and he says, you know, you guys need to let him know that he's severing his relationship with you. He's not going to have the warmth and the care and the loving and the feeling that comes with being a Christian. I've often said sometimes churches can't disfellowship somebody because they didn't have any fellowship to begin with. They haven't built the relationship God calls us to. And it's important to understand that these folks handled this marvelously. In 2 Corinthians, beginning with chapter 2 and verse 6, the writer of Corinthians says, you know, I know you guys did what I called you to do. And now that he's come back and has gotten out of that moral turpitude, you need to just drown him in love. Read it. You need to let him know that love has conquered sin. We have a tendency to want to condemn somebody when they've messed up. How could they do that? Well, we need to be equally concerned that once they've fought their way out of that, that we're right there supporting them and loving them and caring about them. Walk worthy of the vocation with which you were called. We just finished studying Philippians in our Wednesday night class. And one of the things we looked at in Philippians was Paul's relationship to the church there. Listen to these words. I thank God every time I think of you. Oh, every time I think about this church, I am so thankful for the people that are here that have supported and helped me and my family through the years. We've been here 20 years. And there are many of you that have stepped in and helped when we had nobody else that could help. I've all told you about the story that, you know, Cynthia's going at both ends. It's Patty that's there helping clean up. I mean, we go right on down through all of the things that have happened with our family. And hopefully it's true of your family. I thank God every time I think of you and always in every prayer of mine for you, making my requests with joy. Your fellowship in the gospel from the first day until now, being confident that the good work begun in you will continue until Jesus comes. Folks, I won't be here much longer. I'm 80 years old. But this work will go on. We're a heterogeneous congregation. We're not an old congregation. Some of our sister congregations are old, and I think one of the reasons that they're not growing is because they're not looking at the things we're talking about here this morning. It is wonderful for me to think of you because I love you in my heart. God is my witness of how greatly I long for you in Christ Jesus. And this is my prayer that your love may abound more and more in knowledge, in judgment, approving what is excellent, that you will be sincere and without offense until the day of Christ, being filled with the fruits of righteousness by which Jesus Christ will glorify and praise God. Look at the relationship Paul had to the church in Philippians. He's not talking about my chapel. He's not talking about my pew. He's not talking about being in my directory. He's talking about caring, loving, supporting, allowing every one of us to feel loved and cared for and concerned about. A church hung up on issues dies. And so we need to continue to focus on love. Can you really believe, and I realize I'm talking to the choir here, but can you really believe you don't need God? Can you really believe you don't need the church? I think we need to pose that question to people that aren't coming, people that are on the fringes. One of the reasons we have this is so you can send a copy to somebody with notes. I do that every week that I'm here, because it's one way we can reach out, a simple, easy way to reach out. You really think you're number one? What does this do to relationships? You really think you don't need love and support and purpose and direction, a purpose in life, a basis for morality? Does friendship mean something? 2 Peter 2, beginning with verse 9, the Lord knows how to deliver the godly out of temptations and to reserve the unjust to the day of judgment. But these unjust ones, like natural beasts made to be taken and destroyed, listen to this description of our society, speaks evil of the things they do not understand, and they will utterly perish in their own corruption. They shall receive the reward of unrighteousness as they count it pleasure to riot in the daytime. Blights they are with blemishes, sporting themselves with their own deceivings, and while they feast with you, having eyes full of adultery that cannot cease from sin, beguiling unstable souls. Look at the entertainment section of your newspaper. Look at their TV guide. Go on your television. Look at the programs that are there and what they portray. What a description. We offer an invitation every Sunday. The invitation is really an opportunity for people to say, you know, I need the church. I need God. I'm hurting. Pray with me. And if you're here this morning, if you're hurting, and if you want a special prayer, we would love to be able to support you in that way. But let us all in this coming week, in the weeks ahead, take advantage of the sheet Carl and Julie have been praying, been giving us, and work actively. Because we need to do that, not just for the person, but for us. And turn that focus from number one, being not me, but being God. If you're subject to the invitation, won't you come and respond to that as together we stand and sing to encourage you? Please come.